Devon, 10:03 p.m. I scrolled down, and it read Devon, 10:01 p.m. Devon, 9:47 p.m. Devon, 9:32 p.m. Devon, 9:10 p.m. Devon, 8:48 p.m. I ran through all the calls, 26, and all from Devon. All unanswered. I remembered to breathe and felt the wingtip feathers of vendetta scouring the insides of my lungs. I swallowed, watched my hands shake for a moment, and then hit the function button that indicated that in all those calls, there was only one message, and it was from the last call. There was the little voice that said, "Don't do it," but every other voice was screaming at me to listen. It was what I would do for anybody else. It was my sworn duty. I took a guess and punched in "Bear" as the security code. "You have one message." I had none, but I was listening. For the next 2 minutes, I listened to Devon Conliff. He was in a spitting rage and referred to Katie as everything but a child of God. The language he used to describe her actions and person would have paled Vic. He threatened to do things to her that I hadn't heard in a 4-year stint with the Marines and close to a quarter century of law enforcement. Toward the end, he'd become breathless but no less vitriolic, closing with one last salvo that promised a savage retribution if she did not appear within the next minute. The line went dead. I closed the tiny cell phone. Soundings from a very dark place began working their way to the surface. I knew the timbre and the danger of these thoughts. My face cooled where a healthy heat had been, and a stillness crept over my hands. I placed the cell phone in the front pocket of my jacket and hung it on the back of my chair. I pushed my hat back a little, crossed my arms, and looked directly at Katie. The smooth, steady movement of my actions raised a sliver of panic in the rational man who was abandoning me. I wondered what in the hell she'd been doing on the other side of town. Why would she be at the Franklin Institute instead of with me at her house in Old City? Had what happened been an accident, and if she and Devon had had an argument and he had pushed her, why hadn't he called someone? Why wasn't he here? I pulled the phone from my pocket and listened to the message again. I now knew some answers. The next questions would most likely be asked by the fifth largest police force in the country. I had no jurisdiction in Philadelphia. I listened as the sliver attempted to gain a little leverage and force some light into the emotional dusk. But darkness can be stubborn. I sat there in the glare of the ICU and the murmuring of the machines and watched my child as all the shadowy things loosened themselves and began their steady ascent to open air where they could do the most damage. I suppose an hour had gone by when Dr. Rissman came back and checked her vitals. He closed her eye and again looked past my shoulder. I felt like punching him for not looking at me directly, but instead shook my head and cleared my throat. No movement. "It's still early." "I know." He gave her a perfunctory nod and went out to the nurse's station. And I was alone. Again. It was approaching dawn, and the trauma physician had checked in 5 more times with the same results. The faint glow of the sun crept against the adjoining buildings, and it felt like I was in the turret of an unending castle. My eyes must have grown tired because when I blinked, somebody else was in the room. I tried to focus, but the strain of the night made it feel like I was dragging 600 grit sandpaper over my eyeballs. I closed them and opened them again, but the image of the man kneeling by the bed remained blurred. A small panic sparked, and I shifted in my chair, but he put out a hand and stilled me. It was only when the image shifted and I heard the intricate melody of the Cheyenne song that I knew it was Henry. Epigrammatic whispers escaped from him as from a man possessed. and maybe it was the voices of ancestors winging their way onto the tongues of the living. I watched the broadness of his back, drawing in the air of the room and swallowing the damage that had been done to Katie. There was a momentary stillness, and the song began again with a wailing tremble and ended with a final gasp. After a moment he turned to look at me, and I could see that he had been crying, and that he must have been singing for some time. He wore a faded denim shirt that I had seen many times, and the collar was darkened with the tears that still streamed down his face. He didn't stand, but pivoted on one foot and sat on the floor by the bed. He didn't wipe the tears away, and gave me a tight-lipped smile as he folded his hands in his lap. "What has happened?" I explained the medical situation as best I could. His eyes stayed very steady. "How did this happen?" I told him what Michael had told me. His eyes still did not move. "Who has done this?" I pulled the phone from my jacket pocket and tossed it to him. There are 26 received calls on her phone, but only one message. I stood as he pushed buttons. "The security code is bare." I walked around to the other side of the bed to stand over Katie and looked for some sign that would give me hope that she would be in the 34% that made it back. I waited and watched, feeling the heat return to my face, the quiver to my hands. He closed the phone with a distinct snap and sat there. His movements were deliberate as he stood and turned and studied me from across the bed. His voice was strained. "Do not do this."
"Do what?"
"Do not do this thing." He waited, but I didn't say anything. "Do not do this thing because I cannot save you from the man you would become if you do this thing." I took a deep breath and could feel the rattle all the way down on my boots. I guess it'll all depend on what happens next. He leaned in, trying to get within my line of sight. "That is not what it depends upon." I looked at him, but his eyes were drawn to something behind me. I turned to look at the uniform, badge, gun, and Moretti standing in the doorway. "Good morning." "We'll see." I turned back to Katie as Henry made his way around the bed and extended his hand, quietly palming the cell phone into his left. "Henry standing bare." They shook hands. "Michael Moretti." Henry held onto his hand and took a closer look.
"I assumed Vic had eaten any brothers or sisters."
He smiled. "Some of us made it." The bear followed the young man as he stepped to the foot of the bed. "Any improvement?"
"Not really." We all stood there for a moment, and I'm sure I wasn't the only one that could hear my heartbeat. "They say it's still early." I knew which question I was going to have to ask next, so I thought I'd get it over with. "Did you get a statement from Devin Conliffe?" Every trace of the smile vanished. "Didn't see her last night." I turned and looked at him. "What?" He pulled out a thin black notepad and consulted his own writing. "I spoke to Mr. Conliffe this morning, and he stated that he had not met with Miss Longmire." I listened to my heart.
"You spoke with him this morning?"
"Yeah."
The thumping was like the traffic on I-95.
"What about last night?"
"I tried his residence about a half dozen times." I nodded.
"Did he say where he was?"
"Phillies game, and then his parents."
"A baseball game?"
"Yeah." He glanced back at the notebook. "I've got two witnesses, and his parents corroborated. His firm's got a box, and he said he's got it today at 12:30 for the businessman's special." I thought about it.
"He lives here in the city?"
"Yeah."
"Any word on why it is he would have gone to his parents' house to sleep?"
"No." Henry was watching the two of us, finally speaking when the silence got to be too much.
He went from the ballpark in South Philadelphia to his parents' home on the main line, and then back in this morning to go to work?
That's what everybody's saying. He did a lot of driving around last night.
I'm sure the pounding in my chest was causing my shirt to jump.
Did he seem concerned that his girlfriend was lying at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital in a coma?
The young man closed his notebook and watched me for a moment.
Mr. Conniff conveyed to me that the relationship between himself and your daughter was not of the serious nature you might have believed it to be.
He pushed the notebook into the inside breast pocket of his jacket.
He stated that he had been out on a couple of dates with her, but that he had ended the relationship because it was far too serious on her part.
I looked at Henry, who was watching me closely. Devon had lied, and if his parents and two other people had corroborated, then they had lied too. I nodded, and Henry tossed the phone to me. I punched the necessary buttons and handed it to Michael. He glanced at the two of us, and then held the phone to his ear. The young man stared at Katie's feet, covered with a sheet and a polyester blanket, for the full 2 minutes. His expression didn't change. He pushed the disconnect button and closed the phone. I watched him, and then spoke very slowly.
There are 26 received phone calls from Devon Conliffe from 5:11 p.m. through 10:03 p.m. last night, ending with the message you just heard.
I took a breath, pointed to the cell phone, and continued.
To me, that doesn't sound like a man involved in a relationship he doesn't take seriously.
I could barely talk,
and I didn't hear any baseball game in the background of that message.
He held the phone close to his chest.
You mind if I take this?
I think I'll insist. His smile was grim, and I was liking him more and more. He nodded and placed the phone with his notepad.
I may not be the one who talks to you about this next.
I looked at my daughter. That's all right, as long as somebody does, and damn soon.
After Michael left, we sat in chairs on either side of the bed and watched Katie.
It was the right thing to do.
I'd been listening to him think it for so long, I wasn't sure if I needed to reply.
Yep.
He glanced over to me.
Why am I not so sure that you believe that?
Maybe it was the half-hearted response you just got.
Maybe.
He waited.
Is there anybody you want to call?
Not yet.
He nodded, his eyes returning to her. You should get some sleep.
No.
You are not doing anybody any good falling asleep in a chair.
I looked at him.
You might as well lie down.
No.
How about something to eat, then?
I'm not hungry.
He sighed a large sigh. Then go take a walk. Anything. But do not just sit here brooding.
I'm not brooding.
Planning, then.
I looked at him, the man who knew me better than I knew myself.
Concentrate on walking, breathing, eating, drinking, anything but this.
I could still see the streaks on his face.
I will watch her. Go. I didn't make it very far, but I made it outside, and with the number of hallways, elevators, and stairwells I had to use, that was a miracle in itself. I walked through the revolving doors and onto the University of Pennsylvania campus. It was spring. Even in the winter of my discontent, and all the freshmen were hurrying to their 8 o'clock classes. They looked as asleep as I felt. There were a few roach coaches across the street, and I figured I could get a cup of coffee from one of the food carts without contracting a disease. As I stood in line, I noticed people looking at me, and I figured I'd strangle the first one that made a smart remark about my hat. I stepped up to the counter and asked for a large one, which cost me $2.
Here you go, Tex.
I let him live.
I wandered back across and sat on one of the low cement walls that had flowering shrubs planted behind them. My back hurt and my shoulders ached. I took off my hat. Even Atlas shrugged. It was a gorgeous day, and the apple and cherry trees were exploding in a riot of effusive color. I pulled in a deep breath. As a Westerner, I'm always amazed at the balm of eastern air, the coursing, life-giving humidity. Even on the busy street, I could feel the trees, the river, and maybe just a little bit of the ocean off the coast of New Jersey, not so far away. I took the top off to allow the coffee to cool when someone moved my hat and sat on the wall beside me. Lena Moretti looked a lot better than I did. She was wearing a simple floral print sundress and was carrying two small bags that she set on the concrete. She placed my hat on her head, and it dropped down over her ears so that I could barely see her eyes. "Didn't trust me to bring breakfast, huh?" I forgot. She tipped my hat back and pointed to the cup in my hand. "Is that coffee?" I looked at the cup. "I'm just waiting for it to cool." She reached out a hand. "Here, I'll show you what to do with that." I handed her the cup and she poured it out on the sidewalk. A young woman, slouched over with the weight of her backpack, was walking past and gave her a dirty look. "That was my coffee." "No, this is your coffee." She handed me another lidded cup from one of the bags, and I held it with both hands. She opened her own and took a sip. "I took your dog for a walk this morning." "Thank you." I'd forgotten about him. "Where did you find a leash?"
"I used an electric cord."
She crossed her legs at the ankle. I was beginning to think that she was capable of just about everything. I opened my coffee and looked at the decisively dark brew. "This looks strong."
"Espresso, tall, double shot. I thought you could use it."
She looked at me.
"How's she doing?"
I took a sip and swallowed most of the enamel from my teeth. "I figured one of your troopers would have reported in by now."
"He did, but that was almost half an hour ago."
I nodded. "No change." We sat and drank our coffee in silence.
"The Indian up there now?"
"Henry. He ran me out."
She smiled. "Here, I brought you something to eat."
She dug into the other bag and handed me a collection of biscuits and a tiny paper napkin.
"Biscotti. I didn't think you would be very hungry."
"You're right." She chewed on one herself, and I watched as she unconsciously began swinging her intertwined legs.
"Almond, Michael's favorite."
The biscuits were good, and the only sound for a while was the munching of our communal breakfast. I noticed she was looking up at the brim of my hat that was still barely above her eyes.
"Does the Terror wear a hat like this?"
"No. She says they're goofy." She munched some more.
"How disappointing."
She glanced down at my feet.
"She wear boots?"
"She has one pair she wears on special occasions." She watched me for a long while. I took another breath and looked above the buildings to the clear blue sky. I could feel the thumping in my chest as the temptation to turn and count the floors up to 5 tugged at my jaw. A few fat pigeons ambled over from across the quad and positioned themselves in front of us. I broke off a little biscotti and tossed it their way. They grabbed the pieces and looked at me some more, giving up on Lena as a native.
"Dr. Rissman said the damage was blunt trauma from a fall?"
I nodded. "Concrete steps." She didn't say anything for a while.
"She's going to be okay."
I looked at her, still wearing my hat like a child. "How do you know?" She ignored my ridiculous question, smiled, and looked back into the bag.
"I've got a coffee for Henry, too."
I had been about to apologize, but took another deep breath instead. The darkness was there as we made small talk. "You got cream and sugar?"
"Yes."
I tossed the pigeons more biscotti. "He's particular." She smiled.
"I've heard that."
She sipped her coffee and watched as I continued to feed the birds. "We may have to toughen you both up a little while you're here."
The pigeon stood next to the blunt toes of my boots, and I felt the cool in my face, the stillness of my hands. The darkness was with me again, and a plan was unfolding like a crisp linen tablecloth, snapping across the expanse of a long table and floating down to cover everything. Lena, I may need a favor later today. She turned at my tone of voice. Anything? The pigeons were now standing on the wide part of my boots, happily taking the crumbs from my fingers. I may need you to take a shift with Katie. Any time, I'm a woman of leisure. She sipped, and her ginger eyes stayed steady. There were too many cops in her life to fool her for long. You got plans for the afternoon? I handed the remainder of the biscotti to Mutt and Jeff and looked across the street toward the river.
I thought I'd take in a baseball game.
Chapter 4. This is a really bad idea.
I looked around at the thousands of Philadelphia Phillies fans walking along Patterson Avenue toward Citizens Bank Park. 70 degrees and sunny. It's a beautiful day for a ball game.
And a lousy one for aggravated assault.
He looked at me and shook his head.
Where do you want to hide the body?
I just want to talk to him. The bear pursed his lips.
How about behind third? The Phillies have not shown any signs of life there in years.
I bought some upper-tier tickets from a guy standing behind an abandoned magazine stand on the corner of 11th and Patterson. I handed Henry a ticket and stuffed the rest of my money back in my wallet. We were undercover. The Cheyenne Nation was resplendent in jeans, his weathered chambray shirt, and a pair of running shoes. He had bought a Phillies hat as we'd gotten off the subway at Broad and had tucked his substantial ponytail over the adjustable strap in the back. He could have been from Philadelphia. He could have been a very large Indian from Philadelphia, but he could have been from Philadelphia. I was blending in even better. I had left my hat at the hospital on Lena Moretti's head, had purchased a natty fitted cap and a vast red satin jacket from the Broad Street vendor, and now approached the Major League ballpark looking like a British phone booth.
What if he is not here?
Then we watch a ball game. The tiny terror was creeping in on me again, even though we had checked with Lena no more than 10 minutes earlier. She said that 11 lawyers from Katie's firm had stopped in, that even David Calder, the Calder of Schomburg, Calder, Dallin, and Rind, had been to visit. Lena said she had recognized him from Philadelphia Inquirer Society page photographs, that he was ancient, but that he liked my cowboy hat. She also said that Katie was resting comfortably, but had shown no signs of change. We gave our tickets to the lady at the turnstile and walked into the broad interior thoroughfare of the ballpark. Under different circumstances, I might have enjoyed the environs, with the Kentucky bluegrass below street-level playing field, giant scoreboard, and a capacity approximately one-tenth that of Wyoming's entire population. But I had other things on my mind. I bought a scorecard and a stubby pencil from a vendor and stepped onto the metal treads of the escalator for the ride up. Henry lingered behind me.
Do we know which luxury suite?
I shrugged. How many can there be? There were 73, to be exact. This we discovered from a kindly octogenarian in a red straw hat and vest. The bear also asked what we should do if we were invited to stop by one of the luxury boxes but had no tickets. He said we should call our friends and have them meet us at the back of the secured area at the rear of that level. We went up. Henry paused at a railing and looked across center field toward the skyline of the city.
Do all the larger law firms have skyboxes?
I'm not sure why.
Do Schomburg, Calder, Dallin, and Rind have a box?
It's thinking like this that kicked Custer's ass. I held out my hand for his cell phone, a device at which I had become a past master. I only slightly felt the twinge at seeing Katie/work just before I pushed the button.
Schomburg, Calder, Dallin, and Rind, Katie Longmire's office, can I help you?
Patty, it's Walt.
There was no pause, and her voice lowered.
The police were here, asking questions.
Was the name already?
No, a detective by the name of Katz. He left his card.
Patty?
There was a black guy with him. He didn't leave a card, but I think he was a detective, too.
Patty?
They asked a lot of questions about her and Devon. I let her wind down.
Patty, I need some help.
It was quiet. What do you need?
I explained that we were on a little investigative junket of our own and was wondering if the firm had a luxury suite at the ballpark. She assured me that they did and, after a brief consultation, reported that it was being used by a couple of city council people today, but that there were seats still available. I asked her how we could get in, and she said to check the Phillies Community Relations office in 5 minutes. The older lady at the double-glass door smiled as she tore our tickets and handed us the stubs.
Enjoy the game!
The gallery that provided entrance to the luxury suites was a carpeted hallway that arched around the balcony from foul pole to foul pole. We were in Suite 38, and as luck would have none of it, we were right there. When I glanced into the box, I could see two brassy-looking older women drinking beer out of plastic cups that would have looked more at home strapped to a horse's nose. One turned and looked at me, nudging her friend with the frizzy orange hair. "Franny, look, boys!" I stood with my head in the doorway, not sure of what to say, finally settling on a Western favorite. "Howdy!" In retrospect, it probably sounded a little odd coming from someone who looked like the assistant carbohydrate coach of the Phils. I left Henry to entertain as I excused myself to get something to drink. Bernice said that they had waitresses, but I told her I didn't want to wait that long. There were small nameplates beside the doors of each suite, so it was just a question of finding the right firm. I was relying on a distant phone conversation I had had with Katie months earlier when she mentioned where Devon was employed. I remembered it was somebody and somebody, as opposed to the somebody, somebody, somebody and somebody of Katie's firm. I remembered that they were not particularly memorable names, and about a third of the way around I read Hunt and Driscoll. I slipped my scorecard from my back pocket and pulled the pencil from behind my ear when I heard the announcer roar through the starting lineups. I was, after all, undercover. I leaned against the far railing, which gave me a decent view of Suite 51. A few people passed by, but I feigned concentration and raised my head only after they had all passed. I could make out the backs of three young men sitting on the arm rails of their luxury box chairs. They were talking, but I couldn't hear the conversation clearly. Having never met Devon was putting me at a disadvantage, but fortune took a hand in the form of a young woman in short pants and an abbreviated, torso-bearing Phillies T-shirt. Miss? She was another South Philly gem, with mall-chick hair, blue eyeshadow, and rounded vowels. Yeah? Could I get you to do me a favor? Probably. I took this for probably, tucked the scorecard under my arm along with the pencil, and pulled a crisp 20 from my wallet by way of the Durant State Bank ATM. Could I get you to take the largest beer you've got into a young man in that suite by the name of Devon Conliffe? She took the 20, which was a lot even by ballpark standards. It's important that he not know who it's from. What's going on? I duly translated and responded, "It's a surprise." She looked at me for a moment more and then looked at the 20 in her hand. "All right. When you get done, I'll be over there, and there's another 20 in it if you tell me his response." She practically left skid marks. Henry met